welcome to episode 45 of the Infectious Historians Podcast. I'm Merle Eisenberg.
And I'm Lee Mordecai.
It's January 24th, and in today's episode, we're going to talk about teaching the history of plagues and diseases during our own COVID pandemic.
Right, so these are topics I've taught in a few classes about environmental history and disease in movies, but we thought that given the recent increased interest in teaching on this specific topic, we might provide some ideas, thoughts, and guidelines.
Our guest today is Janet Kay. Janet is a lecturer in Princeton's Department of Art and Archaeology and the executive director of Princeton's new Environmental History Lab of the Program of Medieval Studies. By training, she's an archaeologist and historian, whose current book project is entitled Burying the Past, which looks at burial practices and bioarchaeology to study how people in Britain's post-Roman 5th century negotiated their relationships with the past and with their newly arrived neighbors.
Janet has published a book entitled Norse in Newfoundland in 2012, where she explored a famous Norse or Viking site in northeastern Canada, which incidentally I've been hoping to visit for quite some time now. Janet's work focuses on the uses of funerary landscapes and material culture, topics she explores with methodologies such as ArcGIS and stable isotope analyses. And Janet was also part of a team we put together for our article on the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that re-examined the Justinianic Plague and its impact on the late Roman world. So hi, Janet, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, sure. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So not surprisingly, over the last year, I've been asked to give around a half dozen lectures and various colleagues and friends courses on a number of different pandemics in history, which I've been very happy to do. And I also know that several episodes of this podcast have been assigned for various courses as well, since I think some of them really do lend themselves to being easily included in syllabi. But aside from the added lectures on particular pandemics, I think we've also started to see this spring our courses on pandemics and various diseases that have been designed from scratch, as it were, which is something we thought would be good to talk about today in case some of you out there are doing something similar.
Right. It took a bit to build these new courses, but I think they're quite common this year. And Janet is one person who has just finished designing this type of course. So we thought she would be perfect to have on to talk about her plans. And our goal here is to give you a sense of the course she has designed and her plans. And then once the course is done at the end of the spring semester, we're planning to have her back to reflect upon how it all went. But before we talk to Janet about her course, how are things in Annapolis, Merle?
So a pretty standard week, I guess. And there were maybe two things that were different. The first is we participated in a Burns Night celebration that I know you were a part of back when we were both in Princeton, Lee.
Yeah, good times. Used to be good times.
Yeah. And so it was really good to catch up with people during this. The downside was that we obviously didn't get to sit around, as you might remember, Lee, for 2, 3, 4 hours and just kind of chat and see friends. But on the plus side, obviously, the people who host this actually now live in Illinois. So we got to see people really from across the country, which was nice. I imagine there's, you know, some sociological phenomenon that someone's coined about, you know, being alone together or something like that based on outings like this.
That sounds pretty miserable, I have to say. But more broadly, I mean, just like a question on this. Have you been to a Zoom event that has actually been relatively close to like a real event with regards to socializing, or is it always kind of like a fake socializing event in which usually one person kind of like takes over?
Yeah. I mean, I think smaller ones I've been to have been better. I mean, I know I've been to giant conferences, for example, and those don't work very well at all in an online format. Smaller things I think work better. This was a little big. It was, I think, 16, 17 different people. So, you know, but I did get to see people I hadn't seen in a while. My kids were also terrified of one person in particular. So that was quite funny. Whenever he came on the screen, they would run away and hide. And the second thing we did was we started to get bundles of books to pick up from outside the public library down the road from us. So you can get 20 or 30 books at once.
Oh, so they opened the Annapolis Library, finally.
Yes, but now it's curbside pickup entirely. So you tell them kind of what type of books you wanted and how old your kids are. So we told them that, and we got a whole bunch of books on dinosaurs, astronauts, and voting were the three broad themes my kids chose.
Good taste, good taste.
Yeah. And Lee, how are you doing? I know you said your daughter's daycare is closed, so I presume maybe you're not getting sick again at least?
Yeah, she's not sick, so that's actually positive. We've had a Zoom meeting of our own, so one of her, I guess, daycare mates or classmates had her birthday, and that was a very awkward birthday because nobody knew what to do, and the kids didn't really care either. So that did not work very well.
Yeah, I mean, one-year-old birthdays don't work anyways to begin with. I mean, it's just parents sitting around eating, you know, bagels and lox or something. So I can imagine it'd be even more awkward.
We've started to plan our own daughter's first birthday, and it is awkward. I mean, I'm not sure what we're supposed to do, but that's for a different topic, I guess. But more broadly, it's also been a slow week here. We're still under lockdown. Elections are 2 months away from now, but people are still not very excited about those. I did get to walk around downtown today, and for whatever reason, some businesses were open and others were closed, and there was no logic behind that. So some restaurants were open, others were closed. Some stores were open, others were closed. And it's like in downtown, so it really didn't make sense. And there also have been some tensions between the state and different groups in Israel, let's say. And many of these tensions seem to be around how should the state enforce its own laws, if at all. One thing I think you, Merle, might like to hear is that we're currently under lockdown, right? Now, technically, you're not supposed to move more than a kilometer away from your house. Fine. Now, in order to prevent people from moving around, the police has put up roadblocks between cities. Now, these roadblocks, I mean, they're supposed to question people, but because, I mean, you can always either lie or like invent something. So they kind of stopped doing that. And the entire purpose of these roadblocks is to slow people down, right? So instead of taking you an hour to move, let's say, between two cities, it now takes you 3 hours. And the whole purpose of this is to disincentivize you from traveling just because you're going to wait in traffic jams. That's the only reason.
Are the police stopping some members?
No, everyone is being stopped. So you have to pass through the roadblock and they just like either ask you an inane question or wave you through. But you have to slow down and they're doing that on purpose.
Yes, but are they enforcing the laws more stringently for some groups over others as well?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's a given. I mean, that's not surprising anymore since day one of this pandemic.
Fair enough. Yeah. It's interesting how much you've built into this and you are hopeless in the face of it. But, you know, that's for a longer discussion of Foucault.
Your favorite person.
So, Janet, are you in Princeton and how are things in our old stomping ground?
I'm in Princeton. Princeton invited back all undergraduates, and they have to go through a testing and quarantine process before the semester can start. So they're doing that right now. They have a social contract to sign. So we'll see how this goes. I'm hopeful that this will go well.
Are you supposed to teach them in class or see them at all?
We have the option to do a kind of hybrid situation, but most people are teaching online. So they're coming back to campus to learn online.
Yeah, it's interesting. My undergraduate institution, Colby College, invited students back in the fall, and they were actually pretty successful in terms of testing and having everyone there. I think partially because it's in Maine, and Maine had very low rates for a very long time. It's a small school separated from the town up on a hill overlooking the town, actually, which leads to some interesting dynamics. But it will be interesting to see if Princeton can do something similar where everything is essentially self-contained.
I hope so.
Yeah, so I think that at this point, we can probably transition to the interview, which actually has a lot to do with Princeton and undergraduates at Princeton, of course. So Janet, maybe you can give us some background on the course you're planning on teaching. I mean, what exactly is this course and how and why did you decide to teach it?
So as you said in your introduction, I work with bioarchaeology and funerary archaeology. And so I'm already interested in questions of how we can study living societies by looking at how they bury their dead. And when COVID hit and the world changed, and there was interest in kind of past pandemics, it occurred to me this would be a really great opportunity to teach a course on pandemics and plagues, not just so we can learn about the past, but because it would give us some kind of way to take all these gut-wrenching experiences we've had over the past year now and get something out of it. We can connect ourselves better to those past pandemics because we're living through one.
So what's the name of the course and what is it covering?
So the course is called The Art and Archaeology of Plague. So because I'm in the Department of Art and Archaeology, I'm focusing on those kinds of evidence. Also historical texts, literary pieces, but those are minor players in this kind of course. We'll start with the concepts of bioarchaeology and how we can study the past using materials. Then we'll go into ancient plagues and pandemics like the Athenian plague, move through the Roman Empire, the Antonine plague, the plague of Cyprian. Then, of course, we'll focus on the Justinianic plague. Then before the midterm, we'll look at medieval medicine, leprosy, and the rise of hospitals. After the midterm, we'll look at the Black Death for 2 weeks, which is actually going to be wonderful. I have a number of specialist guest lecturers. This is really the one upside to everyone being on Zoom and teaching remotely, is it's actually easier than it normally would be to have an expert on X, Y, or Z guest lecture for a class.
How many different guest lecturers are you planning on having?
Several from within Princeton, and then probably about half a dozen outside of Princeton.
Yeah, and then the course continues, I think, from the medieval period to modern pandemics as well?
Yeah, so after the midterm, we look at smallpox and malaria, especially in the New World and colonialism. Then we move to the plagues of the 19th and 20th centuries, cholera, tuberculosis, the resurgence of what we think of as medieval diseases in our modern era. So then in the last week, we'll look at a lot of the pandemics we've been hearing about recently in the news. Things of the 20th and 21st century, the 1918 flu, Ebola, AIDS, SARS, MERS, and of course, COVID.
So it sounds like your class is really going to go over, I mean, not really all the pandemics, but many of the big stories, right? From antiquity until the 21st century. And I mean, personally, I've also thought about teaching a class on pandemics. And that is definitely one of the immediate ways that came to my mind. But were there other options you thought of and ruled out when you thought about teaching this class?
I mean, one could easily do an entire course of the Black Death or pre-modern plagues or pandemics. But I wanted students to be able to see the kind of progression throughout history of how we think about plagues or pandemics, especially as we bring all these older ideas to our modern period and how we think about COVID.
I think that's a very smart decision in many ways, because I think often we do separate out the pre-modern pandemics from the modern ones and think things are very different, when in fact that's often not the case in terms of both the impact and sometimes how society reacts.
Now, Merle, I remember that you also designed a class on pandemics, right? So was your class different than this one?
No, I think it's in the same general mold in terms of how it's set up. So with background discussion, you know, definitions, what are we doing, and then moving somewhat chronologically. I don't think in its planning it aims to cover as many pandemics as Janet is doing, so that's pretty impressive. I think it's more selective in how I was approaching it. But were there ways in which you were thinking about teaching this, Lee? You know, more on themes, for example, would be the other way to do this?
I mean, so my concern when I thought about this was that there are too many plagues and pandemics and diseases, right? I mean, and the question there is, if I teach many of these, would students actually get what I want them to get out of going over all these pandemics? That's the big question. I don't have a good answer to that. That's why I haven't taught a pandemics class. I haven't signed up to teach a pandemics class next year, although now after this episode, I might change that, and that's for a different time.
That's an issue I struggle with too, that there's so much to do. And one thing that helped is I'm really focusing on plagues or pandemics we have art or archaeological evidence for. So while yellow fever might have been a really important pandemic to study, especially for the Caribbean and for the Americas, there's really not a lot of well-published or even excavated archaeology on yellow fever, whereas malaria is really hot in, if you'll pardon a very, very bad pun there, in plague literature right now. The other thing that kind of helps me keep it focused is I'm less worried that they learn the specific epidemiology and the body's reaction to the pathogen than I am about having them see at different points in history how a society responds to a kind of disease catastrophe. So one of the overarching goals of this is not just for them to learn the material, but to recognize that we're in a really awful situation globally right now. But that's not the first time this has happened. It is absolutely difficult and heartbreaking, and it will not end soon. It will not end quickly, but we will get through this eventually. And some of the fun things I'm learning along the way are that there are occasionally these really interesting good things that come out of a plague or a pandemic. So, for example, the tuberculosis treatment idea in the 19th century is actually the basis for our modern summer camps. So in the grander scheme of things, that's really small, but any of my students who have been to summer camp have the medical reaction to 19th century tuberculosis to thank for that.
Have you been to any summer camps, Merle?
Yes, Lee. I went to day camp for many years, and then I went to a sleepaway camp as well after that.
So a day camp would be just like you'd go away for the day to a forest or so next in New York City or something?
Yeah, not a forest, but you go upstate to a camp. It was actually a Jewish day camp, you know, 8 to 4 thereabouts. And you do various activities, you know, arts and crafts or sports or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I like your image, though, of going to a forest somewhere. It's a very
German fairy tale approach to summer camp.
It is. No, I mean, I haven't been to summer camp. I heard a lot about summer camps, but I have not been to one. So,
yeah, you know, you just got to spend more time in the United States. It's a very Northeast thing to do.
So, Janet, I guess that for some of these pandemics and plagues, the evidence, the archaeological evidence, or maybe even the art history evidence is a bit controversial, maybe especially for the earlier ones. So are you going to discuss some of those controversies as well?
We are. We're going to look at, first of all, the kind of question of whether diagnosing an ancient plague like the Athenian plague or the Antonine plague is actually a question we should be asking. Is it super important, for example, that we know that the Antonine plague was a fever or a bacterial disease? Or is it more important for our understanding of the past that we can see how society has reacted to it? So that's one major question. And as we get into the plagues that are really contested as far as what the pathogen is and how societies responded, especially for the Justinianic plague, for example, we're going to look at a wide variety of different approaches, and the students will learn how to critique the different approaches and the different categories of evidence.
Yeah, I think that one thing that comes up from your answer is that this is a really interdisciplinary topic, right? I mean, you're interested in the art and archaeology, yet really have to discuss the history as well. Obviously, but also maybe the epidemiology, maybe
environmental science too.
But that seems really challenging.
It is. It's challenging in that I have to know a little bit about a lot of topics, but it's actually really exciting because the interest in this course isn't just in my department or in history. I think there are about 25 student majors represented in the current enrolled students. And it's not as if history or art and archaeology is overwhelming. There are engineers, there are biology students, chemistry students, sociology students, language students. So the diversity of sources is going to work really well, the diversity of academic interests and backgrounds.
Yeah, one thing I think we should mention is that this is going to be a huge class.
This is much larger than I think we were all anticipating at the beginning. This is 110 students. I have 5 TAs who are all excellent. So it's a little daunting, but at the same time, it's not as if I'm standing in a lecture hall with 110 students. They're going to be watching all the lectures pre-recorded, and then otherwise it would function like a normal large lecture course where there are small discussion sections. We're limiting those to about 9 students, which works on Zoom because that's what you can fit on one Zoom screen. But other than that, the hardest logistical part of this was actually making sure we had TAs.
One of the hardest things when it comes to pandemics across such a large time period are both the biological differences between diseases, but also the social, cultural, political, economic differences between the societies that are affected by those pandemics. So how are you aiming to balance those two kind of key ideas?
So the way I'm thinking about this course in terms of its larger structure is not necessarily about each specific plague or pandemic and each specific societal response as contained units. But I've called this course the Art and Archaeology of Plague rather than Pandemics, because what I want students to understand is the social angle of all of this combined. And I think when we use the word pandemic, especially as it's been on the news lately, we kind of aim more towards the disease epidemiology angles of these epidemics, of these disease events. And when we were all hunkered down in March and April, frantically watching the television for news about coronavirus last year, I was really struck by how news anchors use the word plague accidentally. They'd be chatting with their guest and they'd say something like, "I avoid X like the plague," and then they'd backpedal and say, "No, I can't say that anymore. That means something now." I was really struck by the idea that they didn't want to use this word anymore. But the sense that we are plagued by something, whether it's an actual disease or we're plagued by bad weather or we're plagued by bad traffic, implies this kind of continual presence of something bad in our lives. Whereas we use pandemic or epidemic as an event that stops and ends. And it might take years, but it has a beginning and an end. And so I want to question that whole kind of dialectic concept. And I want to question what we mean when we say the word plague. So I'll be using that throughout this course in preference to pandemic, which might be confusing because when we think of the word plague, we mean the bubonic plague, Y. pestis. But I want students to really focus on different social approaches to what is essentially a disease catastrophe every single time, but in different ways.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I had a student approach me actually this week about a very similar question, which is to say, the ways in which we use these terms, right? Plague, pandemic, epidemic, both in the present, but also in the past, and how today we read things that were written more than a year ago, really. And they read very differently. When someone says the crack cocaine epidemic, for example, back then it meant something. Today it means something very different. At least my student reading this understood this in a very different manner because of the COVID experience. I think it's a really interesting question to try and tease out the different ways in which we use these terms over time. And that's maybe something we should talk a bit more about. But I did have a question to you, Janet, which is about death. So how important is death, the body count, to be more precise, mortality in these pandemics? Are you going to emphasize the body count, as some of these very nice infographics sometimes do? Or is the body count less important, and what you're more interested in will be to see how society reacts to the disease event, regardless of how many people actually die?
I think you've really coherently answered your own question, but I absolutely agree with it, where the reaction is much more important to me than the actual body count in all these past plagues and pandemics. One, because for some of them, we have ranges saying like between 500,000 and 6 million. And at some point, the number doesn't matter. And it's more about what the society perceives as being kind of the prevalence of the disease or the prevalence of death. Now, numbers matter, right? We're watching the numbers of at least deaths in the US go up to about 500,000, they're estimating. And that's hard to imagine for individuals sheltering in place in your homes or in your community, where many people have lost someone or who know someone who have lost someone, but it's hard to think about numbers that large. So I'm more interested in teaching the students and having them understand how communities respond to these kinds of threats and deaths on the scale at which they can interact with it.
Which I guess is the approach not taken by, let's say, the media, which does emphasize the body count. I mean, whether in the present pandemic or in past pandemics, again, all these infographics that I referred to earlier. But I agree. I think examining how society reacts to these pandemics is more telling than just comparing pandemics or plagues or however we would like to call them based on which one killed more, even though I know some people are very interested in that question specifically.
So yeah, you have this very cool part on your syllabus that I was intrigued by called plague simulations. And they're exercises, you're assigning a few of them over the course of the semester. Can you just first tell us what they are? And then maybe we can talk about a few more details.
Sure. So these plague simulations are one way to assess how well the students have learned the material they've been presented on a specific plague and a society's reaction. But it's another way to get students thinking in these small remote discussion sections as a kind of group unit. And also a way to at least mentally bring students back to Princeton. We have some students who have chosen not to come back. We have freshmen especially who have chosen to not come yet, so they're still learning remotely. So in addition to the standard large lecture kind of midterm and final and participation grades, this is really the point at which students get to flex their creative muscles and take what they've learned in the class and apply it to a vaguely real life situation. So in each simulation, their section will be given a prompt. So one example could be that bubonic plague has hit downtown modern Princeton, which we hope will never happen. And the precept will have to respond as one group unit. But each individual will have to do something different to react to this plague. And it's kind of designed along the lines of mashing up a few of my favorite board games, the most obvious probably being Pandemic, but also to some extent Civilization and Agricola, where each student has to do something concrete. So for example, if they're thinking along the lines of humoral medicine to respond to the bubonic plague, and they want to combat some kind of dry, hot disease, one of them might decide to go to the nearest ice cream shop and buy all the ice cream and distribute the ice cream, which is cold and wet, to all of the infected people with bubonic plague. So they'd have to explain what their action is, what the logic behind it is, in the mindset of the actual pandemic we're applying here. They'd have to work as part of their group. So their specific action has to integrate into the group plan. Kind of like that one episode of Parks and Rec where Leslie Knope has to respond to a disaster in Indianapolis. And they all have to include some kind of visual image, whether it's a map that they've annotated, whether it's a diagram for a new tool to combat the plague, maybe some kind of better vaccination syringe, or some kind of weird hat to prevent miasmas from entering the body. And they're going to be doing all of this through a new teaching technology that the McGraw Teaching Center at Princeton is having me pilot for this course, which is called Yellow Dig, which is kind of a gamification of participation. So they'll have a specific online platform in which to do all this group thinking.
So you mean they're going to discuss things online through this platform?
Yes, it seems to function very much kind of like Facebook does, where you have feeds and you can reply and post images, use emojis, and they get so many points for doing certain actions, like creating a post of so many words, which is a way to help them engage with this group work and at the same time make sure they get credit for doing all this thinking outside of the class.
And how structured is the activity? So this exercise, other than the prompt you said you gave them?
They'll have the prompt. They'll have 2 to 3 weeks to hand in their final collective and individual responses, depending on where we are in the semester. And I want them to hit 5 goals for each prompt. And this is what I'm grading on. An understanding first of how people in the past thought about the specific plague that I've simulated as hitting downtown Princeton. I want them to show their creative thinking skills and adapting these period-specific ideas to modern circumstances. So for example, ice cream as a humoral medicine tactic. Their critical thinking too is really important. Their ability to weigh the options on different variations of a similar response and to articulate why they chose the option they did. Maybe they could have used iced coffee instead of ice cream, something like that. I want them to think visually. This is an art and archaeology course, so that visual thinking and visual communication of ideas, like the infographics you mentioned, is also part of this exercise. And then finally, they need to show that they're working as a team. That's really the core of this assignment.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And I kind of want to actually participate in this. So maybe you'll let me join a group as part of this.
We need an example simulation so they know what they're supposed to do.
We can talk at some point. So do you have any other different ways in which you're approaching pandemics in history as well?
So for one fun thing we're doing after they take the midterm, before we move to the Black Death, their reading for that week is to watch a zombie movie, to think about the idea of plague communicated through zombie movies.
As someone who's taught a whole class, a whole seminar on zombie and disease movies, which I planned before COVID, yeah, it's a great idea, I think. And it helps students maybe reframe their thinking about some of these diseases, whether real or imagined. In a sense, it doesn't really matter.
So for example, I'm having my students watch World War Z simply because it includes a kind of medical CDC, World Health Organization angle. And we could think about plague as a disease rather than maybe watch some of the more popular zombie situations like The Walking Dead or Warm Bodies or Zombieland.
Yeah. Lee, there's a great depiction of Israel in World War Z, as you know.
Yeah, let's say that teaching that specific scene was interesting to do in Israel, but yeah, it was an interesting discussion. And again, I think one of the things that I learned working on this project, teaching this specific class, this movie class, is that these zombie movies seem simple, seem pretty uninteresting from an intellectual perspective, let's say. But I think we actually spoke quite a bit about them and our discussions produced quite a few insights as well.
I mean, one thing about these movies that's interesting is they are actually an artistic and art-based response to pandemics, right? I mean, they're one way in which people in the last 50, 75 years have really thought about diseases in their society.
Right. And art doesn't have to be something that's old that you see in a wall in a museum. So movies are visual art, as you say. One of the things I'm really excited when we get to the last week of the semester is to look at kind of the art response to the AIDS epidemic and how there were movements to let artists who had HIV/AIDS display their art in new situations.
So one question I wanted to ask you, Janet, is about identifying plagues and pandemics in art and archaeology. And when I say identifying, I'm really talking about both identifying the actual plague or pandemic, but also maybe identifying a signal that can be associated with that plague or pandemic. Right. So an example might be, you could find that the ancient DNA of some bacterium in human remains. That would be one example. But the other example would be to identify some change in burial practices, for example, that you can associate or can argue that is associated with plague or a pandemic, but you're maybe a bit less certain. So what kind of ways would you have to look at the effects of plagues, pandemics on art and archaeology?
Sure. So those two you mentioned, burial practices and ADNA evidence of a specific pathogen, are certainly kind of among the toolkit that I'm focusing on as terms of evidence. We're looking at environmental changes. So after the Black Death, if we're talking about a kind of 1/2 to 2/3 mortality event, what does agriculture look like? Does it go back to forests? Does it go back to grassland? We're looking especially at the question of plague pits and mass burials as whether they signify a plague event or just a really unfortunate season in everyday diseases that could also kill you. But in terms kind of which diseases and which events I'm choosing to focus on in this 12-week course that covers about 2,500 years of history is what I'll kind of jokingly but also seriously called the Disney's Hercules model. So the imagery I'm showing my students is actually of the bad guy in the Disney Hercules film, right? Hades. And he has these two little silly minions, as Disney villains always do, who are called Pain and Panic. So the model for a plague in this course as something that we study as a society-changing disease event is something that causes death, pain, and panic. And I don't mean necessarily physical pain, although, you know, that's certainly part of a plague, right? But societal pain, chaos. So those are the kind of the three pillars of what a plague is for this course and why we're going to look at it.
And what about art? So in art, I'm assuming, again, in art, you could find examples of a plague being, let's say, painted, or a movie on some pandemic being produced. But I guess there as well, you probably have indirect effects of a pandemic or pandemics on art. So could you maybe give a couple of examples of those?
Sure. So your question of whether we actually see a portrayal of a disease in art is really key here, especially when we think about the Black Death, because there actually seems to be very little, if not no evidence of any artwork that actually depicts a person suffering from the Black Death. And there's been some really fantastic work looking at this.
How do you explain that, though?
I think on one kind of functional level, if a plague is causing mass societal disruption and quick death, there's really not a lot of time to sit around and paint someone over hours or days, right? You'd be putting yourself at risk to sit in a room with a plague victim, even if they're understanding different disease vector ideas than we are today. But also, if you're just trying to survive day to day, and that might involve fleeing a quarantine or hiding in your house, or you might not happen to have oil paints, there might not be an opportunity to paint. What we're also looking at is really how art responds to these kinds of societal and also psychological events of plague, smallpox, malaria. Especially, what do ideas of death in the afterlife look like? How does that change throughout history after these major events?
Yeah, that sounds really cool. And I'm really curious to see how this all goes. So as I said at the beginning, Janet, we'll have to have you back on at the end, and maybe you can give our listeners some reflections on what went well, what didn't go as well, and how you would change things moving forward.
Sure, sounds good.
So thanks so much for coming on.
Of course, happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Janet.
So I was really excited to hear in more detail how Janet's going to teach that course. And what strikes me as one challenge, and I think it's always a challenge for any large chronological course, is what you're going to cover, what you're not going to cover, and how you approach that question.
Well, actually, there is even another question. Are you going to teach this chronologically or in some other way? I mean, thematically is the obvious other alternative.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the tension. But I think the first time you teach a course, you generally have to at least try the chronological approach before you decide to do it a different way. At least that's how I've approached teaching.
Yes and no. Right? I mean, in some classes and some topics, a chronological approach helps a lot. But in others, it might not really, right? If you jump around geographic areas very frequently, for example, and does chronology actually matter all that much? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, what I think makes this especially challenging is I haven't seen many courses that try to teach a long durée history of diseases and pandemics. I mean, I've designed one, and I think you have as well, Lee, but I don't think I've seen many people actually execute them and teach them multiple times yet.
Right, and I think this makes this specific topic, the history of pandemics, a bit different from other large-scale classes, right? So if you think about classes such as like Western Civ or Roman history or Greek history or anything like that, those classes have been taught by, I don't know how many people, thousands of people, I guess, around the world for hundreds of semesters at this point. There's clearly been a lot of thought put into these and some ways of teaching these classes that seem to work better than others, some topics that seem to fit these classes more than others. And I think in this particular class, so in the history of pandemics, partially because there are very few people who are experts on this, and partially because this would probably not be a very popular course until the recent year or so, there's probably much less work that has been done across teachers worldwide on this topic.
Yeah, I think, you know, people may have done certain pandemics or modern pandemics, as it were, but a 2,500-year history, as Janet's going to be doing, I think is far less common. And, you know, it also begs the question, I don't think everyone's figured out the different themes of what students are going to get out of this, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of different ways that you could approach this with student goals in mind. And Janet gave us a few, but there were many others you could do too.
Right. So one of the first classes I taught was about the Justinianic plague. It was a seminar about the Justinianic plague. And there, I think I struggled with some of these questions as well. I mean, what, how am I supposed to teach something that, as far as I know, nobody's taught before as a class, right? As an entire seminar on. What do I want students to get out of this class? These are questions that I probably should have thought a bit more carefully about back when I designed that class.
Yeah, Lee, it's almost like you maybe should have done some more pedagogy at Princeton.
That's probably true. Yeah, that's probably true. But you learn very quickly, I think, in the field, like very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it also has to do a lot with where you're teaching, how you're teaching, and what your own personal teaching style is. Those are, I think, the three key variables anyways.
And the students you get. It can be very random. So you can have like a great class that helps you even if you're not doing a very good job yourself, or you could do a great job and just not get enough cooperation from the students. So that can also be a problem.
Yeah, that's fair. And, you know, I think the other thing is how much COVID shapes much of what goes on in our class, right? I mean, much of the discourse during COVID on these past pandemics has been about numbers of deaths. And as Janet, I think, rightly pointed out, that's not really a good approach or a good set of questions to really do with this course.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. So reflecting on my own experience here, and I've taught maybe three classes over the past three semesters, which have something to do with diseases, environmental history, pandemics, and so on. It seems to me that, I mean, COVID came up, obviously, in all those classes, but it also came up in a very superficial manner. So students, the class, the discussion didn't engage with COVID very deeply. Different students maybe used some ideas, maybe compared to COVID. It was never prevalent in the discussion. And I think in all three classes, after touching upon that in maybe one or two classes, we just stopped and returned to the actual topic of the class. Now, and another thing that's interesting about COVID is that certain people have very strong opinions about COVID. And this could be, should people be vaccinated or should they not be vaccinated? Is COVID real or fake? And every once in a while, you encounter one of these beliefs in class and it can easily hijack your class, right? I mean, you don't want to spend an entire class that's supposed to be about, say, pre-modern diseases to talk about whether COVID is real or fake. It's just not the point. So in a sense, it's easier to just avoid that entire discussion and focus on the topic of the class.
Well, I hope if the question of whether or not COVID is real or fake ever comes up, that you are able to convince them that it's real.
But wait, is it real, Merle? Are you serious? But the 5G antennas, I mean, they're like...
No, it makes me wonder whether or not, because it's still ongoing, there's been a lot of work on this in terms of scholarship, that people can't yet process where we are in it. And maybe if you taught this course in 20 years, when, God willing, COVID is not a thing that's happening, people will be able to process it very differently.
No, I'm sure it will. And I think in the present, there are also a lot of political issues involved, right? So if you think about, I guess, the United States, should people wear masks or should they not wear masks? And your political leanings would probably affect your answer there. And bringing that discussion into a class, again, you weren't planning it would. In Israel, is the government reaction to COVID okay, good, bad? It's another debate that people would have, which is not immediately relevant to the topic of at least most classes taught on pandemics.
Yeah, no, I take your point. I'm just, you know, more hardline about this than perhaps you are, but such is life. The other point I thought was interesting were her plague simulations. So I'll be curious to know how those turned out for her in the end too.
Yeah, to me, it seemed like a very, I would say, Princeton type thing that I heard. I know you, Merle, you also had all these interesting exercises or unusual exercises in your classes back there, back in New Jersey.
Yeah, but actually, when I did fun stuff like that, it was actually at Mercer County Community College where I taught a Western Civ course. And there, the kids really liked the various role-playing exercises we did. So I would imagine they'd be pretty popular.
Yeah, I'm a bit less into those things just because it seems so random and it's so easy for them to misunderstand or for me not to explain myself well enough. And then it could be a waste of time.
Maybe now you're the hardline what should and shouldn't be in a syllabus like.
No, I mean, in a sense, in that sense, I guess I am a bit conservative. I mean, I would include movies. I would include present day media, for example. That's not a problem at all. I mean, I'm considering how to introduce games to my syllabi this upcoming semester and year. But these group exercises, I mean, maybe because I've never done one of those that actually was helpful for me as a student. So I'm wary about them. Yeah, maybe I just never had the good experience of that.
Yeah, well, I think this always goes down to our own pedagogical design and thinking is always predicated upon how we like to learn ultimately. And unlearning how we learned is perhaps the hardest thing when it comes to teaching.
Yeah, I think that's very true. So a lot of my thinking about teaching is about reacting to my own experience, either trying to replicate things that worked well or just pushing against things that did not work well. But it's very difficult for me to consider things that I've never encountered.
Yeah, that's fair. As I said, it's the hardest thing to unlearn.
Okay, so I guess that as we conclude the episode, Merle, I know one of your favorite things to talk about are TV shows, and I know you've also watched quite a few TV shows recently, and we haven't spoken about these in a while. So maybe if you don't mind updating us on what you've been watching, is there like The Mandalorian season 3 or so?
No, but I guess the two things I've been watching, one with my wife and one on my own, obviously, as you are certainly aware of, Lee, the new season of The Bachelor is ongoing. It was back to back with The Bachelorette. And so I'm watching that every Monday, 2 hours.
Is that by yourself or with your wife?
No, obviously with my wife. We very much enjoy The Bachelor and The Bachelorette.
Sorry.
But, you know, I know you're waiting to see who Matt James is going to end with. The other show I've been watching recently is Turn, which is originally a show from AMC about spies during the Revolutionary War. It's not bad. So it's entertaining as a show, but it's one of those shows where you get really into it toward the end of the season. So I'll watch, you know, 2 or 3 episodes at the end of a season very quickly, and then the new season will start and I'll just get bored and not want to do it for months on end. So it's been actually a years long process to get through the show.
Sounds like fun, I have to say.
You know, always got to mix things up. And you, Lee, last time I wanted to talk about TV shows, you just said you don't watch TV. So are you
okay,
done?
I did not watch TV because I was very busy with the semester, but I'm very glad to announce that the semester is over.
I believe, though, you did tell us about you putting on a VR helmet and waving around a lightsaber or something. So you clearly had time during the day.
Well, that was exercise time, and I still am doing that. Well, you're still doing your Peloton thing, right?
Of course. You know who else is obsessed with this Peloton?
Who?
Joe Biden. There was a long article about him bringing his Peloton into the White House and whether or not it would be a security breach because it has to run on Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I saw that piece of PR, and maybe we can talk more about politics off record because I have quite a lot to say about that. But yeah, I mean, the semester is over, and to kind of like celebrate the semester being over, I started watching The Expanse, the recent season of The Expanse, which I've watched all the seasons before. I have mixed feelings about that show. I think it's definitely creative, definitely done well, produced well. I have my concerns about how well it's written, but yeah, maybe you can talk about that if you want.
Well, I'm completely caught up on this season, Lee. So when you catch up, we can talk about it maybe in a future episode.
Yeah, I will say that after teaching an entire semester of zombie and disease movies, some themes repeat themselves over and over, both in those movies and also in sci-fi movies. And I think the thing that jumps to my mind is family, right? I mean, family, parenting, parents, children. I mean, you can argue that that's like the main theme in Star Wars, right? In all Star Wars movies.
Yes, it's called existential thoughts about life. Like you could say it's about literature or anything.
Okay, nice of you to bring in the fancy words.
What do you want me to tell you, Lee? Sometimes I got to teach you fancy words.
No, but they did bring in family big time into this season. I've seen one episode so far, and I think there have been like six out at this point. Family is much more present in multiple plot lines in this season than in previous seasons.
Yeah, that's fair. But as I said, once you're caught up with the season, we can talk about it. Otherwise, I don't want to spoil the season for you.
Okay. Yeah, now I'll watch everything now. Yeah. Like, no pressure there.
Yeah, no pressure.
Okay. So I guess that on this note about TV shows and freedom, some freedom of time, yeah, I guess we can conclude the episode. And we'll do that again by thanking the LePage Center for funding this podcast. And thank, as usual, our great webmaster, Veridra Kanati.
Until next time, stay safe, stay socially distanced, and maybe recommend a TV show for Lee that's not about family.